It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a book that's bringing up tough conversations about race is growing in popularity in Wisconsin schools. We'll take a closer look in a special collaboration with Wisconsin Life. First, our next interview covers the topic of suicide, which has been in the news all this week. If you or a loved one are feeling suicidal, you can find help by calling the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. New research published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that suicide rates have increased across the country by 25% since 1999. According to the CDC, nearly 45,000 deaths in 2016 were attributed to suicide. The release of the reports coincides with two high-profile deaths by suicide this week, Chef Anthony Bourdain and designer Kate Spade. Our next guest is here to talk about the research and about public health efforts that can help prevent suicide. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, based on past conversations we've had as a public health expert, I'm guessing these new numbers, while alarming, are not that surprising to you.
Well, they're both surprising and not. They're not surprising in that we've known that suicide is a leading public health problem, and that people really don't appreciate it because there's a stigma related to suicide and related to a common cause of mental illness. But it is surprising that it's one of three causes of death that has been increasing. And we like to think in public health and in healthcare that we're learning more and taking that knowledge and applying it into prevention and into practice. And we'd hope to see progress in every area of health and healthcare. And this is one area where we're going in the wrong direction.
What do we know about why suicide numbers might be going up in Wisconsin and around the country?
Well, the CDC published a really detailed report. Not only do they collect data from every state from death certificates, which tell you a little bit about the cause, the means, for example, whether it's poisoning or caused by a firearm. But for 27 states, they got much more detailed information, including history of mental illness, including whether the decedent left a suicide note, and all sorts of detailed information. So I encourage the readers to go to the CDC webpage and check out the incredible amount of detailed information. What we see is that suicide is really complicated, that there are no single causes, and that meaning that the solutions, that interventions or prevention approaches, are going to have to be just as complex.
Mental health is often mental health problems are often associated with suicide. This report finds, yes, often, but not always, a very substantial proportion of the people they studied here hadn't been diagnosed with mental illness prior to suicide.
That's right. About half, just slightly over half of people had a history of mental illness. Most of that was depression, but fully half of people who committed suicide did not have such a history and did not have any evidence from their past medical history that might suspect that they would commit suicide. I do think when those cases are examined closely, and again, this data is online, they can see some evidence of suicidal thoughts. They can see some evidence of financial problems, some stress in relationships. So although those aren't considered, you know, a diagnosis of mental illness, they certainly are factors that increase the risk of suicide.
Economic problems. We had the economic downturn. Is that something, you know, it may be hard to pick out at the individual level, but at the societal level, is that something that can drive an increase in suicide?
Well, in two ways. We, of course, hear about this anecdotally, the story of a relationship that breaks up, a diagnosis of cancer or a foreclosure on a farm. Individual grabs a gun or goes out and hangs himself. So those are anecdotal. But there's good evidence that In addition to a history of mental illness, these everyday stresses can accumulate, and for some people, lead to suicide. And the other factor that the report talks about is the combination of stress or mental illness combined with access to a lethal means. And firearms are clearly the most efficient and effective way to kill oneself. People have a relatively easy access to firearms. And so if you, it's really a perfect storm that maybe an economic downturn or unemployment or increases in substance abuse, you combine that with easy access to firearms. Again, not necessarily the individual's firearm. It could be firearms stored in the home or of a parent or a relative. And those two factors really are deadly.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about new numbers out from the CDC showing an alarming increase in suicide in Wisconsin and around the United States. Dr. Remington, let's talk about prevention now. We hear messages, especially after high-profile suicides, as we've seen a couple this week, for people dealing with this problem to seek help. Is there enough help out there right now?
Well, clearly there's not. The healthcare system is pretty good at diagnosing medical illnesses and treating people who have traditional chronic illness or cancers or heart disease. But we have an insufficient number of primary care providers, especially in rural and underserved areas, and in particular, people who focus on mental health. So that's one barrier. And again, I'm looking at a map of Wisconsin that our state health department put together. There's an excellent report that really dives deep into the data done by our colleagues at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the state health department. And you can see the rural counties have the highest rates. Adams and Juneau County lead the state, Green Lane County, Vilas County, Burnett and Polk. These are places with an acute shortage, not just of primary care doctors, but of mental health providers. And you combine that with a stigma that is present with mental illness. People are afraid to go and seek a provider, afraid to, that friends or neighbors or family members would find out. And so you have barriers all along the way for the detection and treatment of mental illness.
I want to talk about that stigma and the rural area. In the commentary on this report, it was brought up, if there is one provider, say a mental health care provider in a rural community, it's a small rural community, everybody knows what everybody else drives, and if there's that stigma, do you want people to see your car parked in front of the mental health provider? That overcoming that stigma, even where the services are available, might be a big part of the story here.
I don't think we have the answer to that question. I served on a panel at the CDC, and the goal of the discussion was to overcome the stigma of mental health. And I asked the question, why do we call it mental health? We call other things diseases. Cancer now is not stigmatized as much as it was. And so we still call it mental health providers when, in fact, people have a disease. They have a brain disease. They have mental illness. And they need to be in care. And care can be very effective. But if even the term mental health is a way of not actually saying the word mental illness or a mental disorder. And so we have to overcome the stigma. That's a goal of the nation, goal of our state health plan, but it is very hard to do. We had a family member who committed suicide, and although it's been talked about within the family, it really is not shared more publicly, and we really need to get over that. Mental illness is a condition that can be diagnosed and treated effectively, but again, the stigma is a tremendous barrier.
Overcoming that stigma is probably a long-term change. Some of the resource issues might be, too. Is there something that could happen quickly, maybe not super expensive, to try to get more access to care to rural Wisconsin?
Well, again, there's an excellent state health plan available, and it's a comprehensive approach. We like to think about these complex issues and talk about a public health approach, which means it's not sort of a single solution. It's a complex set of solutions. So you want to reduce the risk of suicide by better care and diagnosis of mental illness, and also people who maybe express concerns about their mental health. You also need to reduce access to lethal means. And there are effective ways of doing that, trigger locks, locking guns in homes so that youth and others can't access it that might be considering killing themselves.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about a recent report from the CDC, which found the rates of suicide increasing across the country, including here in Wisconsin. If you or a loved one are feeling suicidal, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-8255. Now to tell us more about the guide for white women who teach black boys, we're joined by Eddie Moore Jr. He's the founder of the National White Privilege Conference and co-edited the book. Eddie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I think people talk about these issues some, maybe not enough. What led you and your colleagues to say, hey, we need a book, we need this guide?
Well, I think some of it is connected to the statistics. I mean, some of the research shows the number of white teachers, the increasing number of students of color, the disparities associated with those numbers, particularly as it relates to black boys, incarceration and some of the gaps associated with that in reference to the school-to-prison pipeline. So I think there's some real concerns around the numbers. But also, I think being someone who spent a great deal of my life in the Midwest, especially in Iowa, where I did all my education, just running into a lot of good teachers, a lot of good educators who just want to do better. These are not folks who want to produce the kind of gaps and disparities that we see in the numbers. They actually want to do a better job. And so I think dealing with the reality of the numbers and really running into some folks who want to do a better job, trying to create a resource that could assist in that, and those two things coming together.
In your book, you talk about reactions from some teachers saying, hey, teachers are teachers. Basically, kids are kids. As long as you've got a caring teacher and kids who want to learn, it's going to work out. It's more complicated than that, you write.
Yeah, for sure it is. I think anytime you put people in with different backgrounds, different experiences, I mean, you got to factor all of that in, particularly if you're in a complex environment like schools and education, where sometimes the design of the structure, the institution, wasn't necessary for all the students that are participating in the instruction in the institution. And so I think that what really happens in schools is such a complicated formula that it's not enough just to be a good person with a good heart who cares about their kids, that it takes a craft, a skill set, a learning, an ongoing learning, a challenging, a real assessment of value. I mean, a lot of things to really be effective as a school teacher, especially when you have diversity and complexity associated with that diversity in your classroom.
As we heard in that Wisconsin Life piece, this can be an uncomfortable conversation to have among teachers and, as we heard there, between teachers and kids. How do we overcome that discomfort to get started?
Well, my philosophy, anything you do over and over and over again, you'll get better at it. I think part of it is just a commitment to ongoing evolution. I mean, what was striking for me in that piece is how comfortable it seemed the kids were.
Yeah.
So to just see young people really, really ready and willing. And so sometimes I think we dumb kids down. We slow them down as adults because we're not ready. So my philosophy is, let's just get you in there and get this process started. And you'll get better at it just like you do with reading, with writing, with languages. Anything else we take on in the curriculum, we take our approach where we enter people in at 101 and we try to get them to 401. And it seems like diversity and topics around race and other issues like privilege and power, we just don't want to deal with those in that same evolutionary process. And so that's the approach I have. Most importantly, though, because young people are ready and they're hungry for this conversation. And I think as adults, we owe it to them to have them better prepared for a kind of world that they're going to be living in that's very different than many of us grew up in.
What are some of the main stumbling blocks that just come from the different backgrounds of, say, that white woman teacher and her young black male students?
Yeah, I mean, the profile of the white teacher is monocultural, coming from a monocultural, single culture environment, monolingual, limited exposure around any kind of multilingual environments, as well as, in some cases, some fear associated with particularly black males. And in some extreme cases, we have some outright racists in our classroom. So there's some real hurdles there when it comes to black kids coming into particularly Midwest environments, where we see a lot of these kids not ever been in an environment where they've sometimes experienced white folks who really care about their well-being. They're coming in believing that white people are aimed to make their lives miserable. So there's some real education that we have to do with kids around building trust with white people, white women teachers specifically, and also helping them in their home environments, because it's not always just the school, that there's some responsibility and some real tough conversations that we have to have with people who are connected to the kids at home. And so I think those are some of the just immediate thoughts that come up around some of the hurdles. But by and large, I think that the book has been created to be a guide that says we have black boys in our classroom that are brilliant. We have teachers in our classrooms that are really committed and want to do a good job. They are often put into an environment that wasn't designed for those two to be successful together. And so the book now takes those two pieces into account and tries to create a map, a guide to help them to be more successful over at least the next 25 years as we look at it.
Just briefly, we're just about out of time, but do you see in working with schools, talking to teachers in the short run, when people start thinking about this, talking about this, do you see improvements happen in the short run?
Absolutely. I think that we can definitely see some measured progress. The key is a comprehensive commitment, that we can't just settle for the isolated case. What we also have to be admitting to is some of these disparities, particularly around the school-to-prison pipeline, are increasing. And so simultaneously, while we have some individual success stories, I mean, the stats, the numbers, particularly in Wisconsin, continue to show some real concern. So there's some work to do.
Eddie, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eddie Moore Jr., founder of the National White Privilege Conference and co-editor of the book, The Guide for White Women Who Teach Black Boys. There are four universally recognized flavors of food. You got the sweet, the salty, the sour, and the bitter. But over a century ago in Japan, a fifth flavor was identified. It's called umami. And just in the past decade or so, we in the United States are coming around to discovering its cooking potential. Adam Fleischman is a restaurateur and author of the new book, Flavor Bombs, the umami ingredients that make taste explode. His gourmet burger restaurant, Umami Burger, has locations around the world, and his recipes focus heavily on that umami flavor profile. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I know about this umami mostly because of this show, Adam. Talk us through the basics. What is umami?
Well, you know, most people think it's a theory or a sort of conceptual thing, but it's really an actual taste comprised of glutamates, which are amino acids, and they create a savory sensation on the palate, and the center of the tongue detects it, and it's probably, you know, one of the most craveable tastes, along with sweet, obviously, and salty for some people.
And you've got a lot of ingredients to start your book. What are some of the main ones that we might use in our day-to-day cooking that add some umami?
Well, if you were Asian, you could use fish sauce or soy sauce or miso. If you're Italian, you could use tomatoes or dried mushrooms. If you're French, you could use veal stock. There's Marmite and Vegemite. There are all kinds of truffles. Those are all high in umami.
And I'm trying to puzzle out, as you say these, like, there's almost like a sensation I can think of even without these foods in front of me, sort of a, it's hard to define, but like a rich, savory sort of feeling on the tongue, right?
Yeah, it's a feeling on the tongue that kind of creates a lasting permanence, which is what makes us crave it, as opposed to certain flavors that you taste them and they dissipate very quickly. Umami is a much longer palate presence and It's also found in the most popular foods in America, like burgers and pizza and things like that, that people love.
And Adam, people like umami, maybe without even realizing it, you love umami. You're really gone all in on umami in your cooking. Why is this something that grabbed you in particular?
Well, about 10 years ago when I first started cooking, I had this epiphany where, you know, what I was really craving in a dish was the umami, and the dishes I liked the most had all this flavor in it. So I decided to come at cooking from the angle and perspective of umami rather than from a set type of cuisine. So I sort of created my own umami cuisine. And it's fascinated me and the rest of the chefs in the world ever since.
And you write that you did this with a lot of trial and error, and you encourage people to try that too, to kind of experiment and find umami flavors that work in their cooking. Give us a pep talk to try that out.
Well, it's always a leap of faith. You know, I would go to these supermarkets here in L.A., and they're like Japanese supermarkets, and they had millions and millions of products, and I figured, well, if they have so many products, someone must be buying them, and they must be good. I'm not sure what they are. So I would just buy stuff, and over time, I would get the fortitude to just try and put them in cooking. And you fail a lot, and you have a lot of mistakes, and eventually, you find something great.
Talking to Adam Fleischman, his new book is "Flavor Bombs: The Umami Ingredients That Make Taste Explode." Well, let's go right to a recipe that you've shared with us. We've got this at wpr.org/foodfriday. You named one of your restaurant chains after this, the Umami Burger. So we all get the gist of a beef burger. Talk about what goes into this to make it an umami burger.
Okay, so I wanted to approach the burger from the perspective of umami. So I looked at this website that had the relative sort of glutamate counts of all different products. And the ones that had the most umami of any were Parmesan cheese, shiitake mushrooms, and kombu, which is a seaweed. So I decided to make a burger that had all three of those things in it. And, it took some trial and error. No one had ever really put Parmesan on a burger before. And we figured out a way to do it. And the concept was born.
Yeah, talk us through the recipe and how this comes together.
So basically, you have to change the texture of Parmesan because it's very hard. So you grate it and then you bake it first, so it becomes sort of like a potato chip of cheese, and that's going to contain a lot of the umami. You saute some shiitake mushrooms. You roast some tomatoes so that sort of concentrates the umami because there's a lot of umami in tomatoes, but there's also a lot of water being a fresh ingredient. So you want to kind of dry it out a little bit, not quite to the sun-dried level, but to like sort of like a middle ground. And then you make a dust out of different umami products like the kombu, and you make a sauce, and you make a homemade ketchup, which is in the book as well, and you combine all those things, and then when you eat it, you get a real palate length and a real hit of umami in it.
Yeah, this sounds great, and the umami ketchup I like, and it's this is something you can make and then keep around and just splash on anything you'd put ketchup on. What are some of the things that make umami ketchup special?
Well, I wanted to sort of recreate, the traditional ketchups are great, but back in the day they had more umami in them, and they kind of took that out over the years because they wanted to make it more vegetarian-friendly or vegan-friendly. So we added those things back, things like anchovies and things that gave it more depth of flavor, along with the tomatoes and the sweetener and the vinegar, which makes a ketchup. So it's just really a reformulation of ketchup with an eye towards adding more umami into it.
Yeah, actually, that makes me think vegetarians are not necessarily left out in the cold here when it comes to umami. A lot of your ingredients are a veggie or even vegan. You don't have to always go with the anchovy or the beef flavors.
No, you don't. In fact, the original ketchup recipe that was created 100 plus years ago was a mushroom ketchup. It wasn't even a tomato ketchup. So umami's been in there since the start, and it's a lot of these ingredients are vegan. I mean, you have miso, which is made of soy. You have a lot of yeast-based products like Marmite, and they make these yeast powders that you can put in things that are very cheesy and flavorful and full of umami, but still vegan.
And I was just flipping back to the Umami Burger page and stumbled across the Veggie Burger. What are some of the key ingredients that hold that Veggie Burger together?
So what I do is I use sort of a vegetable protein or a grain, and then it's filled with these really meaty-tasting mushrooms and dried mushrooms together. So when you put that together and with the ketchup and everything, it really has a very satisfying umami taste without being meat in any way.
Now, you've got a list of Adam's principles of flavor in the book, and one of them caught my eye. Number three, I think. The more you hate a dish, the more likely it is you'll come to love it later. That, I don't know if I buy that. Yeah. Talk me into that.
Well, you know, as a chef, you're forced to eat everything. And I noticed a lot of the things that, you know, theoretically did not sound super delicious, and maybe even when I tasted them, if you stick with them over time, you can sort of appreciate their inherent qualities. And here in L.A., we get a lot of interesting foods like uni and sea urchin, things like that. And, you know, sea urchin was my least favorite food. It was the last food I came to like, and now it's my favorite food because I sort of developed a taste for it through palate memory and persistence, which we talk about in the book.
Yeah, it seems like you want to avoid something that's a bland. It's kind of okay with everybody, but nobody's going to fall in love. Nobody's going to love it or hate it. You want to avoid that.
Exactly. It's like the ugly duckling that becomes a swan, really.
We are talking about umami flavor with Adam Fleischman. His new book is Flavor Bombs, the umami ingredients that make taste explode. Umami is this fifth flavor, people call it. He's helping us get it into our cooking. And you can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of this umami, these umami foods or ingredients? Have you made your own recipes inspired by it? Or do you go to a restaurant that does a good job of this? Or do you have questions for a guest about the concept, the chemistry, the flavors of umami, and how to work it into your own cooking? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, get a link there to that umami burger recipe and a dessert with mushrooms in it. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Adam Fleischman. His new book is called Flavor Bombs, the umami ingredients that make taste explode. And you can share your umami-related questions or comments with us now at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this idea, this flavor of umami? Have you done things that work it into your own cooking? Do you have questions about what to do with these kind of ingredients, where you can fit it into what you're making at home? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David is with us in Westby. David, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? So my question is this. The other morning I was going to saute some spinach, and I thought just kind of on a whim I would give a splash of fish sauce, which is, you know, kind of a common ingredient in Thai cooking and that kind of thing. And as I ate it, I thought to myself this exact word. I thought, is this kind of a really good example of that flavor umami? And I guess I just wanted to ask Adam what he thinks about that.
David, thanks. Adam, that Thai fish sauce, umami?
Yeah, I mean, Thai fish sauce and Vietnamese are one of the highest umami ingredients. In fact, it occurs in many different cultures, including the Romans discovered fish sauce couple thousand years ago, and they called it garum. But anchovies and vegetables are a classic umami pairing, and I have a recipe in the book that uses collard greens and instead of the spinach, but it's very similar to what you mentioned.
David, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, Adam, you share some good pairings, umami synergy, things that go well together. You can't just throw, I guess, all the umami ingredients in a pot. What are some combos that really seem to work well together?
Well, in my mind, the greatest combo ever is cheese and tomatoes, and that's why pizza is, even when pizza is not super great, it's always good, because it always has that classic combination of cheese and tomatoes. And the cover of the book has a cheese and tomato dish on it. And I just feel like when you're using those two things together, you can't go wrong.
I want to get to the other recipe that you shared with us. We did the umami burger. People can also go to WPR.org/Food Friday and find a dessert called the Piglet. And it's this chocolate thing that looks awesome, but it's got some mushrooms in it. Tell us about this one.
So there's not that many desserty umami ingredients. There's green tea, matcha tea, which some people use in desserts. So I wanted to sort of get some umami into dessert. So I came up with this idea of taking dark chocolate, which to me is sort of like an honorary umami ingredient. so satisfying. You know, it doesn't contain umami, but it mimics the pleasure, if you will, that you get from umami. And I wanted to use mushrooms, so I made a crust with some ground mushroom powders and things, and then I made a dense sort of rich chocolate ganache tart, and then I covered it with a sort of a porcini mushroom caramel. And I was not expecting it to taste very good, and it ended up being probably my favorite recipe in the book. It really doesn't taste mushroomy. It tastes more sort of earthy and chocolatey.
Right.
So the chocolate and the umami work very well together.
And I think you said this one was kid approved. You managed to sneak in those mushrooms without it being detected?
Yeah, I fed some to my kids and didn't tell them what it was, and I don't think they've ever even had mushrooms, and they really liked it. They were raving about it.
And it's called the piglet, the dessert, because of the porcini mushrooms. Do I have that right?
Yeah, porcini is like piglet in Italian, so they I named it the piglet after the mushrooms.
Okay, so it's still a vegetarian recipe, though.
It is. You can certainly add some lard to it, and it won't hurt it, and make it more umami, but it is vegetarian.
Talking to Adam Fleischman, restaurateur. His new book is called Flavor Bombs, the Umami Ingredients That Make Taste Explode. You can call in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or your own experiences. Also, find the recipes we've been talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. We heard from Vern and Stanley. Vern called to say that using the flavor packet from ramen noodles can really add depth of flavor to any dish, including homemade stuffing, spaghetti sauce, or even chicken. So those very salty flavor packets in ramen noodles, Adam, are they going to have these umami flavors in it?
Why, they certainly are, because they're going to have something called MSG in
it. Oh, yeah.
A synthetic umami. So the salt and the MSG are what gives you that flavor and that using those packets. In the book, I don't use MSG for obvious reasons, because even though I like it, it's not as creative as finding your own sources for umami and coming up with them rather than just adding something that's synthetic.
If somebody wanted to do something like that in, say, their spaghetti sauce, Vern mentioned, if not that flavor packet, what kind of things could you sneak in there that are going to boost the umami that's already there with the tomato?
You would use the umami dust, which is in the master recipe section, which is a combination of that dried kombu seaweed, some dried jitake mushrooms, some dried anchovy, some garlic, some powdered soy sauce, and some salt and some freshly ground white pepper. Grind those all together in your coffee grinder or spice grinder and add it to your sauce.
Ooh, that sounds fantastic. Now, anchovies are popping up a lot here, either anchovies themselves or in sauce form. And it seems like, yep, from where I'm sitting, anchovies are making some kind of comeback. I think they're kind of like the joke, oh, anchovy pizza. But people are getting back into anchovies lately because of this umami thing, I guess.
Yeah, there's other ways to use them than the ones on pizza. And the ones on pizza generally tend to be not the highest quality anchovies, whereas the ones in fish sauce, like the Red Boat fish sauce we recommend in the book, it's an ultra-high quality anchovy where all it is steeped in water for a long period of time, and it kind of soaks all that flavor out. So it's really a great ingredient to use in any stew, any sauce, any braise. It's a great ingredient, and, you know, in Italian cooking, they've always thrown anchovies into meat dishes like lamb and beef dishes because they're not trying to get it to taste fishy. They're trying to get it to taste more of itself, like an umami booster.
And you mentioned time there, the amount of time it takes for that umami, and it seems like that's kind of a secret ingredient. It's just time. Some of these dishes, yeah, some of the sauces need time for the flavors to merge together.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're doing something quickly, you can do your spinach and just hit it with some fish sauce or soy sauce at the end. But then there's also, you know, your long braises, and those things kind of commingle and marry all the flavors together. So I have a chili recipe in there that is by far the best chili recipe in the world, and you can simmer it all day, and it's got tons and tons of umami ingredients in it, including mushrooms and fish sauce and things like that. And over about 5 hours of, you know, braising over low heat, it becomes just this very complex, savory, meaty deliciousness.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Let's go to another caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Kelsey with us in Madison. Kelsey, hi.
Hi there. I was wondering if Adam could expand on the veal stock. When I think of veal stock, I think of leeks and tomatoes, and I'm wondering if that's what he uses or if he makes it in the book.
On the veal, in the book, I recommend using a pre-bought veal stock because it takes way, way too long to make, and these are sort of home cooking recipes. And there is one on the market that I give the info on that's a really excellent one. But basically, the reason veal stock is so great is because it's reduced down into its like base umami. So you start with all this liquid, and over many hours, it just becomes this very thick sauce. So you're getting sort of the essence of those tomatoes, mushrooms, and veal, of course, has lots of umami, and the veal bones specifically. So it's a great ingredient, but it takes too long to make for your daily dinner. So I would buy it or make it one weekend and freeze it and then use it in little ice cubes or something.
Okay, Kelsey, thanks a lot for calling in. Another good shortcut recipe I like, you've got a risotto, and that's risotoat, as in risotto made with oats. I don't make risotto because, you know, the rap on that is it takes a while. You got to be standing there and stirring. You're stirring, so you can't make the other stuff you need to make. You're using quick oats to do something like risotto. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I love oats for breakfast like everyone, and it can be really delicious. But then I started adding sort of the umami stocks that I've been making, like the fish stocks and things like that, and realized it was just absolutely delicious as sort of a grain. So it's a great way to make a different kind of risotto than you're normally used to without having to cook rice all the way through. These oats just soak up all the flavor and just create a beautiful thing. Just have to get used to eating something savory rather than breakfasty.
Adam, hit us with a few ingredients. If we're like, okay, this sounds good. I want to get to the grocery store and just have, you know, three or four new things in my arsenal to add umami to this and that. What are a few of the things that would be at the top of your list?
The top of my list, not everyone has Worcestershire sauce, so that's a good one. That's sort of an American version of fish sauce, British version or Anglo version. I would buy some dried porcini mushrooms, which I think are great and everything and widely available now. And I would buy, you always want like a good hot sauce in your arsenal, like pimenta espalette, something like that. What else do we have? I use nutritional yeast seasoning is a really good one. You want to get some yeast in there, and then of course the block of fresh Parmesan, not the pre-grated kind, and then you just grate it, and that's a really good way to get umami into things.
And Adam, you kind of came into cooking as sort of a mad scientist. It seems like you got your ingredients, you're trying them. Efforts A, B, and C might not pan out, but D is fantastic. Do you have experiments that you're working on now or that are on the horizon?
Absolutely. I'm starting a coffee brand, and all the coffee takes 3 days to make. It's sort of an infusion of all different flavors. One of the coffee drinks has dehydrated fish sauce in it, and everything's martini shaken and stirred, and it's basically like a cocktail bar, but without alcohol.
Okay, man. It's going to be a hard sell for me. Coffee and fish sauce? That really works?
It really, really works. Everyone who's tried these recipes has said it's the best coffee they've ever had by far.
Wow. Was this one where you had some failures along the way before you hit the good stuff?
No, it worked from the beginning, but I've been working on this recipe for, literally 10 years before I started Umami Burger. I was going to either go into the coffee business or the umami business. And I went into the umami business, but this has been 10 years of work. Of experimentation.
Fantastic. Well, if I show up there, I will give the coffee with fish sauce a try. Adam, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That's Adam Fleischman, restaurateur, coffee connoisseur, too, it turns out, and author of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Flavor Bombs, the umami ingredients that make taste explode. We've learned about how to harness the power of the fifth flavor, also known as umami. You can find the recipes we've been talking about today on the Ideas Network Facebook page and maybe share some recipes of your own while you're there. Or you can head over to WPR.org/Food Friday. Two recipes there, that piglet dessert recipe because of the porcini mushrooms mixed in with the chocolate, and this looks fantastic, the umami burger, adding a lot of different layers to those burgers. Find those and a lot of other recipes, all the recipes we've shared on Food Friday, are at WPR.org/Food Friday. Can you identify this sound? A piece of technology mostly from the past. Well, that sounds really piercing in the headphones here. Yesterday, I asked you to share a piece of technology that was once important in your line of work, but is now mostly obsolete or out of use. Well, Mike emails, I'm a self-employed freight broker. The fax machine, that was that sound there, the fax machine was an integral part of my work 10 years ago. All my business is done by email now. I'm guessing that's a common story for a lot of people where, you know, I worked in retail, you faxed your orders back and forth. We used faxes. We got all our press releases by fax once upon a time. We fax material to people at other bureaus here. We still have those fax machines around the studio. I don't know. I don't know if the legal department uses them. I can't remember the last time I had cause to fax anything here, though I hear that the doctor business, there's a lot of faxing that goes on there. I'm not entirely sure why. Maybe you can let me know why that is. Here is another audio sample of something that one of our listeners shared, a technology from the past of their profession. And Carol said that's from the world of computer programming. Those are the punch cards. You can keep sharing your no longer used technology. Ideas at WPR.org is the email. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is the Ideas Network.